Okay, so welcome to your, I think, third class on multiculturalism and diversity. And I was taking you through some key dates about multiculturalism and racism and anti-racism and seeing how they came up there. And if I remember correctly, I'd gone through the 1930s, those terrible 1930s, such a long time ago. And I'd moved on to the big immigration waves. Now, I was just looking at a television program the other day about black people in Britain in the 17th century. Yeah, there have been black people in Britain for many hundreds of years, but the numbers are different. And it's true that industrial society and modern transport, cheap ships, meant it was possible for far more people to come. And also remember, after the Second World War, the government sent ministers to the Caribbean, to Jamaica, and said, we need workers, please come. And you found a large number of Caribbean workers, especially in public employment, especially the National Health Service, the hospitals. And this is because, unfortunately, private employers were not so keen on avoiding discrimination, yeah? The place you could get a job was in the hospitals, on the buses, driving the buses, working in a hospital. This was the classic Caribbean thing to do in the 50s and 60s. And I got as far as then this act, this new idea, whereas in 1948, when they thought it was a way to keep the empire together, to give the name British citizen to everybody in the Commonwealth. Yeah, so you had British citizen, British Commonwealth citizen, and they had the same rights. They could come to England any time, Britain any time, and have the right to vote, which is still the case. But in 1962, this changed, partly under pressure from racist ideas. Yeah. And there was a kind of a double movement from the government. They said, okay, we want to reduce discrimination because it causes trouble. I think that was the main perspective of the government. I don't think the government was, you know, we want to reduce discrimination because it is so horrible, discrimination. No, I don't think so. It was more, we want to reduce discrimination because it causes trouble. The fighting in Notting Hill in 1958, social unrest, yeah? And on the other hand, we want to reduce immigration. So reduce discrimination, reduce immigration was the idea of the governments after the 1960s. And when they say reduce immigration, they're not talking about Australians and Canadians and Americans. Yeah, they're talking about India, Pakistan, the Caribbean, and so on. So it's always had a sort of white domination thingy. So here we have the next three big dates. 1965, the first Race Relations Act. 1968, Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech. And 1977, the Anti-Nazi League. You're the next three, dates there. Do you know anything about any of these? Approximately nothing. Yeah, approximately nothing. Okay, that's fine. That's why I'm paid so well. Yeah. Okay. So first of all, the first Race Relations Act, and the first thing you notice if you're French, saying la première loi sur les relations entre les races. Wow. On parle pas comme ça en France. Yeah. Because and the reason for this is that the word in French race is the word you use for animals and dogs, and in England race is not that. Yeah. And so this is why the word race, you see it around in English, whereas in French, it's kind of, you know, well, it's not very polite. And even today, they still talk about racial equality, or racial inequality as well, and so on. So the first Race Relations Act, now, as we will see in a moment, the first Race Relations Act was extremely mild. On the other hand, I think it was the first one in Europe. That is, that although it was a very light touch and in some ways, you know, didn't make a huge difference, it was the first country to try to do something about it. Enoch Powell is dead now, which is good. Enoch Powell was a Conservative minister who made a horrifically racist speech which changed the world. And the Anti-Nazi League is, as its name suggests, is an organisation, an anti-fascist organisation. Now, I've chosen three dates. Of course, something happened every year. Something happened every month. So I'm simplifying, of course. So let's get started off then with the Race Relations Act of 1965. Here we have a Labour government. After 1964, we have a Labour government. So it was a little bit left-wing. Not extremely left-wing, but a little bit left-wing. And this is the government, for example, which will make it legal to have an abortion, which will make it legal for male homosexuals to be homosexuals. So it had some progressive elements to it. And the Race Relations Act, for the very first time, made some kinds of discrimination illegal. Yeah. In 1964, a year before this act, if a the shopkeeper could say to you, I'm not serving you because you're black, in 1964. And that was not illegal. Welcome. That was not illegal in Nigeria. I'm desperate. I have to welcome people in. You know, people are not coming. The 1964 racial discrimination was not illegal. So this is for the very first time. It is a little bit illegal. As you can see, the Act made it a civil offence to refuse to serve a person, to serve someone with unreasonable delay, or to overcharge them, to change the prices. If you overcharge somebody, you add something to the price, on the grounds of colour, race, or ethnic or national origins. So that meant that after this law, things were different, and if you went into a shop and they said, I'm not serving you because you're black, then the police didn't come. It was a civil offence. You were allowed to go to find a lawyer and go to the tribunal, and the tribunal would... Yeah, so you have to do all the work. Yeah? It's not a criminal offence, it's a civil offence. But nevertheless, it was illegal to discriminate. This changed quite, you know, a lot. There were a lot before 1965, there were a lot of pubs where it was impossible for a black person to get the beer because they just wouldn't serve them. Yeah, and so this was the beginning. Now, as I say, it was extremely mild, but... pour défendre un petit peu les Anglais de temps à autre, c'était le premier pays d'Europe qui faisait quelque chose. That's already something. I don't know the detailed history of anti-racist legislation in France, but my impression is that the British law was the first one. 3 years later was this incredible event, the Rivers of Blood speech by Enoch Powell, which I should give you a copy of, really, because it's pretty horrible. This is a politician who made a speech saying, if we continue in this way, the blacks will dominate the whites in Britain, and there will be blood in the streets. That was what he said, yeah? Okay. And he justified this by a series of stories. I met a man who told me that his cousin knew a person who's white. You know how racists do this. You know, they have a horrible story, but it's always a cousin of a cousin. Yeah. Now, that's not so surprising. A lot of people are racist, but this man was a top conservative politician. Everybody expected him to become prime minister in a few years' time. He was right at the top. So that was very different. Yeah, that this was a very racist speech by a very top person, whereas normally you would expect somebody more marginal to go in for this. The Conservative Party at this point are not the government, they are the opposition. And the Conservative leader, Edward Heath, thought that this was not acceptable, and Enoch Powell lost his job at the top of the Conservative Party. And the following day, there was a quite important strike of several thousand people went on strike to defend Enoch Powell in the immigration departments and in the docks, the dockers. A whole load of dockers went on strike to defend Enoch Powell. So this is very, very unusual, and a racist strike in Britain. I think there were two, one in 1968 and one in 1919. It's not traditional. Indeed, traditionally, at least over the last 50 years, trade unions have been more involved in anti-racist campaigning and not in racist strikes. So enormous shock to the system, and you could see painted on the walls, Enoch was right. You can see it painted on the... Enoch Powell. Yeah, Enoch Powell, yeah. And that was his name. Now, what's very interesting is that exactly 50 years later, in 2018, in the same room where he made the speech, they had a big anti-racist festival. In the same room, exactly 50 years later. So this was very, and people believed it at the time, but this was, apart from being horribly racist, it was also completely untrue that he was saying in 50 years, he was saying in 10 years, in 20 years, there will be blood in the streets, yeah? So his theory, which a racist theory, is that it is impossible to live in the same community, yeah? That was the idea. So we already knew he was wrong, but it's been demonstrated to me. And indeed, I would say, because I was 8 years old in 1968, and I would say that everyday racism has declined. There's plenty of racism in Britain today, but the everyday racism has declined. When I was 15, I heard a racist joke every week. No, it was endemic. It was the normal thing in my white school. And today this is not true. I have nephews and a little, and I talk to them. Oh, no. Yeah. They're still racist, but at least the racists have to keep their mouths shut. So in 1968, this incredible, horrible speech which really shook the nation. And there you can see a graffiti. Here you have a black gentleman walking along in London, and behind it, him it says, Powell for Prime Minister. Yeah, Powell for PM. The supporters of Powell have been there. So if we move on another 10 years, we can. I've chosen the date of 1977 and the Anti-Nazi League. The post-war boom finished in 1974, 1975. You say in French, les Trente Glorieuses. À sa fin. And it sounds, you know, it's a word we hear all the time, and it sounds a bit pretentious and glorious. But on the other hand, you know, it was pretty glorious. There was no unemployment. But the funniest thing about it is that after 29 years of the Trente Glorieuses, people did not say, oh, we only have 1 year left. No, of course they didn't know. The general opinion in 1972, 1973, was that mass unemployment is finished forever. We had mass employment in the 1930s. After the war, almost no employment. In 1969, my father got angry with his foreman, and he walked out of the job. He said, I'm leaving. He walked out of the job on Thursday, and he found a new job on Monday. Yeah, don't do this. It doesn't work today. It's too late, yeah. And of course, because there was no unemployment, people were very confident. And if the boss didn't treat them very well, they'd talk back to him because, you know. So it was a different world. But we didn't have Japanese restaurants or the internet. So yeah, you could band it up. And also, we are now old, which is bad, and you're not, which is good. So the in any case, the end of the post-war boom in Britain led to a rise of unemployment for the first time, and a lot of cuts in public services, cuts in hospitals, you know, cuts at schools, and as people sometimes do, especially people who are not very intelligent, they would say, whose fault is it? Whose fault is it? And in the 1930s, of course, it was the fault of the Jews, as people said. And today it's the Muslims. And in any case, in the 1970s, people blamed, not a lot of people blamed black people. So the National Front, the fascists, didn't get to the level in France, but they got to, in some towns in the north, they had 20% of the vote, 25% of the vote, the fascists. And the response was the formation of the Anti-Nazi League, which had a very simple program. First of all, they went around to people's houses giving information about the National Front. And secondly, every time the National Front had a meeting, it was stopped by the Anti-Nazi League. So in fact, every time the National Front had a meeting of 50 people, there were 200 Anti-Nazi League people outside protesting. And the National Front gradually became demoralized by this because they couldn't bring anybody along. You see, the fascists said, oh yeah, I'll bring my neighbor. Oh, I'll bring my teacher. And of course, new people don't want to come if there's going to be trouble. And so it seems to me that it was quite good. And it also produced some of these wonderful badges. It was always somebody against the Nazis, you know, so you have building workers against the Nazis, single parents against the Nazis, and West Ham United against the Nazis. It was just there were about 1,000 of them. Some of them a bit bizarre, you know, like sort of left-handed vegetarians against the Nazis. You know, it was a kind of jokey thing. And Skins Against the Nazis, for example. And this is the book, which is the history of the anti-Nazi League, which seems to me to have been relatively successful. Of course, the fascists did not disappear forever. Well, they disappeared for 20 years, which was a fair start, I thought. Yeah, so that was 1977 to 1981. At the same time, close to the Anti-Nazi League, you had the organisation Rock Against Racism. Now, rock is a kind of music that people used to listen to. Have you heard of this? Yeah. Well, that's a joke, but I know that rock is no longer the national religion as it used to be in the 1970s. Rock Against Racism had another idea, and what they did is they organised a large number of concerts around the country. These are local concerts, yeah. They're very cheap. The posters are not very good. They always had the same structure. They had one white group, usually punk rock, because punk rock was white, and one black group, usually reggae. And the reggae group had the best position, and that's just what they did. They said, you know, it's rock against racism. One punk group, one reggae group, come along, and of course they did a lot of propaganda against racism and against the National Front. Now this was mostly set up by political people. Most people who went to the concerts were not very political, but it was begun by political people, because things usually are. That's how it works, you know. However, what was interesting is it also mixed together audiences which never usually saw each other. So, for example, punk rock concerts in 1976, 1977, they were white. Not because they didn't want black people, it was a tradition which had come up in, and the same thing, reggae concerts were black. And for the first time, they were in the same concert, and this gave rise to a lot of new musical acts who mixed together the two, and a certain number of mixed groups. Yeah, that was the first time, really, that popular music had been hybridized in a big way. So, well, that's the 1970s, and they led up to this enormous carnival in London, Carnival Against the Nazis, in 1978, April, with some of the biggest punk, X-Ray Specs, rock, Tom Robinson Band, not political rock, and reggae Steel Pulse. Steel Pulse is one of the two or three biggest reggae groups in the UK, because you've got a sort of British reggae coming over. Of course, you've got the sort of Bob Marley and Peter Tosh, who remain close to the Jamaican origins, and then you've got white reggae like UB40 and things like that. So you've got all these mixes up. And so this was an important moment. Indeed, one of my friends who's a professor, who is old like me, he said, I remember because I was at school and suddenly it was not cool to be racist. Yeah. And that was the objective of the campaign. So obviously it was mostly aimed at white people, because white when it comes to racism, white people are the problem. And it said, you know, the objective is racism is no longer cool. Which is, you know, which is an interesting idea and way to look at these things. Okay, and I have another series. I have another series of thingies here. Another series of what? Another series of dates. Another series of dates here. Does anybody know anything about any of these? Has anybody heard of Stephen Lawrence? It's maybe vaguely. Okay, oh, that's good. Oh, le projecteur est en surchauffe. Veuillez nettoyer le filtre. Do you have children? No, nothing. Just checking. That's fine. It might explode, you see. It'd be a pity if she died. So that's English humour. It's not. It's very black. It's very negative. It's only a joke. I'm sure it'll be fine. It must have a cut-out thing. So, 1993, Racist Murder of Stephen Lawrence. 1999, publication of McPherson Reports. I'm going to switch it off for 5 minutes. Because I don't like that. Oh, I don't like that. So I'm just switching off for 5 minutes while I give you. I don't want anybody to die during my class. Yeah. Afterwards, you know, that's fine. Okay. First of all, the racist murder of Stephen Lawrence. Okay. Well, that doesn't sound. I mean, it sounds like an anecdote, and it's not. Now, every now and then, people get murdered by racists. You know, every few years, there's that event, and it's terrible. It doesn't usually change history very much. But Stephen Lawrence was very exceptional. Now, I don't mean as a person, he was also exceptional as a person, but the story was very exceptional. So in 1993, he was waiting at a bus stop, and a group of local racists came along and started fighting with him and knocked him down, and he died. So he was murdered. Now, this was not the first time in the 1980s there had been racist murders. You know, not hundreds, but, you know, there had been every now and then. I mean, you know, that's unfortunately how things work. But this was different. And what was different is that everybody in that part of town knew this group of white racists. Everybody knew who it was, really. But the police didn't care. And so they didn't try to find evidence, and it became impossible to prosecute them. And this caused a national scandal. This caused a national scandal that for the first... So what was different from a racist murder in the 1970s is that a racist murder in the 1990s caused a national scandal. And it was shown that, indeed, that the police were not interested. I have some pictures about this, huh? It would now not work, but there you go. It was shown that the police were not interested. And indeed, what happened then was that because the police were not interested and everything went very, very slowly, the family decided to carry out a private prosecution. Normally, if you are prosecuted for murder or something, then it's the government who does it. Or in Britain, the Crown Prosecution Service. In this case, the family chose to do it just came back. No. The family chose to do a private prosecution, but they didn't have money for very good lawyers, and so the private prosecution, the jury decided they couldn't prove that they were guilty, and so this was of course a big problem, because if you are accused of murder and then you go to the tribunal and you are not found guilty, you cannot be accused again of the same murder in most countries, and in Britain that was the case. So it looked like I will come back to this, don't worry. It looked like they were going to get away with it. And this caused a big scandal. There was Stephen Lawrence. So it became clear that they were not going... Everybody knew who they were, and they were not going to be successfully prosecuted. And here you have the Daily Mail saying, murderers. These are the five racists. The Mail accuses these men of killing. If we are wrong, let them sue us. And I think this may be the most historic front page in the history of British publishing, because the Daily Mail is a very, very conservative paper. Yeah, much more conservative than Le Figaro. C'est pas tout à fait valeur actuelle, but it's more conservative than Le Point or L'Express. Yeah, and so. Of course, this is the kind of front page you imagine would be in Socialist Worker and not in the Daily Mail. And so really what this means, apart from the fact that, you know, sometimes the Daily Mail can be honest, what this means really is that they understood that the situation is different. in the 1970s, there was a racist murder, and the general opinion was, well, oh, you know, sometimes happens, it's pity. And in the 1990s, this was no longer possible. The ideas of multiculturalism and diversity had advanced, and it was a national scandal. And so here you have. Now, as you can imagine, this was quite brave in a way. If you are a newspaper and you put people's pictures on the front page saying they are murderers, you're taking big risks, yeah? Because they could take you to a tribunal and ask for $1 million, because, you know, £1 million, because, you know. And so the fact that the Daily Mail took this risk is amazing. Now, so it looked in 1995, it looked like it was a very sad story, but that was the end of it. They had been to court, they had not been found guilty, and so it looked like we had to just forget it. But there was a big campaign, in fact, in particular, Doreen Lawrence, Stephen's mother, organised a big campaign. And she managed to, when he was in London, she managed to get a speaker to help her. And this speaker was a good person to get you to help you in a campaign. This was Nelson Mandela. C'est vrai que si jamais tu peux avoir Nelson Mandela de ton côté, ça peut toujours aider. Especially in the 1990s, of course, he'd just come out of prison. So it became a very big campaign. And the new government, elected in 1997, the new Labour government, asked for a report. They said, in 1997, they said, we want a report. We want to know, why were the police not interested? Why did the police not collect evidence in this case? What happened? And so they asked a committee, this is the way you do things, the government asked a committee to study the police and see what is the problem. Yeah? And this is called the Stephen Lawrence Inquiry, and it was a report by Sir William McPherson. Now, as you can imagine, Sir William McPherson is not a dangerous radical. He's a he's a retired judge. You know, he's a part of the elite. And when he published this report, it was an explosion. Because in this report he said, the police of London are institutionally racist. Yeah? Now, again, this is the sort of thing that, you know, Yves Olivier Besancenot says it. Well, that's normal. But if this is a bit, c'est un peu comme si Jacques Chirac disait, la police parisienne, c'est une institution raciste du haut en bas. Now, this would be, you imagine, I mean, some people like Jacques Chirac and some people don't like Jacques Chirac, but that would be politically dynamite. And this is what happened, absolute dynamite. And this report by a very respected member of the elite recommended many, many changes in the police and in public organisation generally, in the name of Stephen Lawrence. Now, there is also the story of the case itself. That is to say that the government also passed a law to change the conditions under which you can have a second prosecution. And so they made it possible to have a new trial, if I remember correctly, three of these people are in jail because they had a second trial. Because they found, this was now the 1990s, so they could find DNA, which previously the technology was not the same. I think there's one of them still living in Spain and having a good time. So if you see him in Spain, you know, say hello from me. There are several of them that are in jail. So that's the personal question, which of course is also very important. But the political side of it was the passing in 2000 of a new Race Relations Act, the Race Relations Amendment Act of 2000, whose aim was to take into account the recommendations of the McPherson report. And it is quite new and a little bit difficult to explain, so I'll tell you about it. And in fact, some of the ideas were inspired by Australia and Canada, who have some original ways of looking at it. There are basically three big groups of ways of dealing with discrimination. So number one is the old way. In Britain before 2000, it's illegal to discriminate. And of course which is obviously a good thing, but the difficulty is it can be very difficult to prove Yeah, I didn't get the job. Is it because you're black? Oh, well, difficult to prove. Yeah, and so that's the limits of the old way. And indeed, although discrimination is illegal in Britain in 2000, 99% of television news readers were white. 99% of judges. 99. You know, after all, I think there's something going on. The other side, the other possibility, is one which was used very much in the United States in the South, and this is to have quotas. And in particular, in the South of the United States, in the universities, I know that this example, they found themselves in the 70s in a situation where they had a university, 90% of the students were black, and all the professors were white, because of the history. And the only solution they found is to have a quota and say, okay, from now on, 20% of all professors must be black because we want this to change. Yeah? So that's the quota method. Now, the Race Relations Amendment Act tried a third possibility. They did not establish quotas. There are no quotas in the United Kingdom. With one exception, there is sometimes a quota for Catholics in Northern Ireland. But this is that what they did is they said every public body, town council, hospital, university, school, public body, any public body, is obliged to promote racial equality. Promote racial equality? Well, what does that mean? Well, they have to show that they are trying to rebalance the workplace. So let me give you an example, a hospital. This is not a real hospital, it's an imaginary hospital, I made it up. But it's believable. When you take a hospital in London, 1,000 workers, half of them are black. There's nothing surprising here, there are plenty of hospitals where half the workers are black. 100 managers, 96 are white. Again, we're unfortunately not so surprised, especially 20 years ago. Maybe today it's different. And so under this law, the hospital must prove that they are taking action. Now, they're not allowed to use quotas, so they have to take other action. Let me give you some examples of the action that this imaginary hospital might use. First of all, we know that when you have a recruitment committees everywhere, even when they do not want to discriminate, they recruit people who resemble them. We feel more up with it, yeah. And so what they would do, this hospital, would say, okay, every recruitment committee now will be half black. And somebody would say, but we don't have enough managers. So, okay, well, even if we have to invite a manager from Glasgow, a black manager from Glasgow, and another one from Liverpool, and another one from Birmingham, it doesn't matter. All your recruitment committees are half black. And this is something they do, yeah. And they find that... well, first of all, the black candidate who walks into the room feels a little bit more like it's possible. Another example. Every year, they have a special training course, a 3-day training course for workers who would like to become managers. And this training course is only for black people. This would be a typical tactic. So a lot of different tactics. Those are two good examples, I think. Because, of course, one of the problems of getting people to be managers is that dominated groups, subaltern groups, say, I'm only little me. I don't think I could be a manager. Yeah, and so these encourage. Well, this is 2000. I mean, 2000 is a long time ago. It's 20 years ago, you know. And it has had some effect. Now, unfortunately, I haven't seen a good analysis of the effect. It's true that there are more black managers in hospitals these days. That's true. And even in the Parliament, there are more non-white people in the Parliament today than 20 years ago. No comparison. So that was the long-term result of the Stephen Lawrence case. That is, that this terrible tragedy came to make a difference in the law. And indeed, this was also used symbolically because at the 2012 Olympic Games, at the opening ceremony, and the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games is very, very important. There are 800 million people watched it in the world. Yeah. So you really can see I'm very, very interested to see what France will do for an opening ceremony in 2024, because it really is, you know, show the world what you want. And in the London ceremony, the person carrying the torch into the stadium was Doreen Lawrence. Stephen's mother. Now, okay, it's just a symbol. But, you know, symbols are important. He said, you know, we want the entire policy to be around that. So that was that new law there. Three years later, there was another law, which also is a little bit original, and in particular, probably impossible in France. Now, I'm very biased, and I just want to remind you, I don't mind if you think it's a good idea or a bad idea. That's not the problem. You just need to understand how it works. Yeah. And this is the Employment Equality, Religion or Belief Regulations, 2003. And what this says is very simple. That is that all employers are obliged to make reasonable adaptations for people's religious beliefs. That's the text, I think. An employer is obliged to make things easier for people of different religions. Let me give you an example. If you have an imaginary hospital with 1,000 workers, and 300 of the workers are Muslims, and they say, "Oh, we want a room where we can pray in the hospital," then the hospital is obliged to give one. They have 1,000 workers, they have a lot of rooms, it's a reasonable adaptation. So in a hospital there will be a prayer room. However, in another workplace, you have a small shop with 5 workers, and 3 of them are Muslims. In this case, the employer is not obliged, because it's considered that in a small shop, finding a special room is not reasonable. Yeah. So it's reasonable adaptation. Let me give you another example. In a big supermarket, you have a lot of workers, and some of them are Jewish, and one of them is an Orthodox Jew. He said, "I don't sell alcohol. I don't want to sell alcohol. So please don't make me work in the alcohol department." The employer is obliged to say, "Okay, no problem," because it's a reasonable adaptation, because they have a lot of workers. However, if it is a small shop, just a small shop with a few workers, then they're not obliged to say it's okay. You don't have to sell alcohol. So this is the idea of reasonable adaptation, those are the two examples I thought of. So this is a whole idea. This is part really of the back end of multiculturalism, which in this case is in some ways being enshrined in law, because of course multiculturalism is a theory. It is practices, things people do, things schools do, but most things that schools do are not obliged by the law, and then this is the law. However, it has to be said that since 2003, the position of multiculturalism has retreated somewhat. That is to say that for the last 10 years we've had a conservative government, and the conservative leaders have more and more said, "Well, we think that multiculturalism has its dangers. Yeah, we don't really want to defend multiculturalism anymore." Now, it's impossible for them to go back to the situation 30 years ago, because politics doesn't work like that. But you get more and more, you get politicians saying multiculturalism is divisive. It's more important to think about community cohesion. These are the words that they like to use. And indeed, in 2010, they brought all the different laws together about gender equality, and about gay equality, and about racial equality, and they were consolidated into the Equality Act. Some people think that this made them somewhat weaker. There is no specific anti-racist laws anymore. There's just a general Equality Act. And here you have a website giving you the information about the public sector equality duty. This is the same idea, that every public body is every hospital, university, etc., is obliged to promote gender equality and to promote race equality and so on. Now, what is fascinating about this whole set of laws is that they only apply in the public sector. If you are a private factory, it's not your problem. Okay? Except that sometimes it is, because let's go back to our hospital with 1,000 workers in it. This hospital buys a lot of tables and a lot of beds and a lot of cleaning materials. They buy a lot of things. And typically in this hospital, the trade unions will be saying to the manager, we want you to buy your beds from a company which has a good record on racial equality. So they will be pushing them. So some parts of the private sector, although there is no law, are obliged to show that they are taking this question seriously if they want public markets. And public markets is a lot of money, yeah, of course, because it's nice to sell a table to somebody who needs a table. But if I get the order for table from the University of Rouen, that's even better. It's a lot of tables, yeah. And in Britain, if I wanted to sell tables to the University of Rouen, somebody would be asking me about what my company does about racial equality. Yeah, I'm imagining myself as the owner of a big company. I'm not, or I wouldn't have to do this. But there you go, what can you say? Le projecteur est en surchauffe, moi aussi. Okay. So finally, a couple of definitions and... I'll go back to this in a moment. I'm going to... I'll come back to this in a moment. I have a few videos I want to show you, but I want to start with this one then. On va continuer avec ça. À moins que ça explose. Okay, so I'm going to show you this an extract from a video, and then I will continue with the last bit of, which is a little bit about what's happening today, or a few things which are happening today. Around